Brian Maffley, let's actually start with National Monument news. This past week, actually over the weekend, I think, some information was leaked out of the White House related to this report from the Interior Secretary on National Monuments. What did we learn, first off, from this leak?
Well, it's unfortunate that the document had to be leaked at all. We feel, a lot of people feel, it ought to just have been public when Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke submitted his report on the 27 national monuments to the White House. It wasn't made public, and last weekend it was leaked to the Washington Post. It's 19 pages, and it identified 10 national monuments of the 27 that were under review that ought to either be made smaller, which is what he recommended for the two Utah monuments,
right,
or make some kind of changes to them so they're less restrictive on what you can do there. Like open up the marine monuments to commercial fishing, was, for example.
Well, we'll get to that. But for the you mentioned that for the Utah monuments being reviewed, Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, we know that a size reduction is recommended. Do we know the extent of that?
No, we don't. That's part of this is a bit of a non-story in that we've already known all along that Secretary Zinke was going to be recommending reductions to those two Utah monuments. And to be fair, they're the two of the three biggest. National Monuments and BLM's Landscape Conservation Network, 1.9 million, 1.3 million, very big monuments. What this report did not do was specify, you know, how much they should be reduced, or even what parts shouldn't be in the monuments.
So, I mean, no maps of what might be the new monument.
No, but the report does indicate that specific recommendations for these 10 monuments are available, you know, should the White House want them. So those are what we'd really like to see.
And again, these are leaked recommendations. As of yet, though, no word on what the president might do with these recommendations.
No, the Interior and the White House aren't really revealing much.
The state, though, has submitted its own suggestions for these monuments, for Bears Ears particularly.
For Bears Ears, not for a Grand Staircase that we know of.
What do they say?
Well, for Bears Ears, Robert Gerke and I sent grandmas to a number of state agencies, and the materials we received included a large map from the governor's office outlining what the governor would like to see, and it was a national monument of about 120,000 acres centered around the Bears Ears Buttes.
A reduction in size of
about 90%. Okay. Yeah, 93%. So a huge reduction. But then it was had this idea for special management recreation area, mineral withdrawal for Cedar Mesa, the large southern part of the monument where a lot of the archaeology is, a national recreation area designated for the Indian Creek area, the far north. And a few other things that were not on the map. We sat down with the Attorney General's office to say, okay, what would the state like to see here besides the lines on the map? And their thinking is by having a national monument, you're actually going to make the archaeological resources there more at risk because you're going to be bringing in more people that might trample, pick up artifacts, damage them in some ways. We know that there's tens of thousands of archaeological sites there. One of the other things we learned is just how little the state knows about what's there. So, you know, according to the surveys they've done, only less than 10% of these lands have been surveyed for archaeological resources. And they've helped identify where the highest concentrations are. So interestingly, the places where you have the known highest concentrations of archaeological sites are not inside the monument boundaries proposed by the state.
Okay. Yeah. Recommendations from the state to the Interior Department, is that correct?
Well, to the Interior Department, but some of these things Interior can't do on its own. You would have to have the Congress to do it, like designating a national recreation area that would be administered by the Park Service.
And then meanwhile, recommendations from Interior to the President, and we're waiting to see what the President might do with that. There's also some waiting on what you might call the other side of this being done by people who want to see Bears Ears implemented, because despite everything, it's still a national monument, and tribal leaders in particular are frustrated by this. Tell us that part.
Yeah,
of the story.
Well, here we are, you know, almost a year after, 9 months after, and we don't have any signs up. None of the planning that is envisioned in the Monuments Proclamation has even been started yet, and it can't start because the Interior Department's promised the state of Utah that it won't begin planning until this uncertainty is resolved about the monument's future. Mm-hmm. It's very much up in the air. So here it's interesting. BLM is in the Forest Service has ordered the signs. I hear they're beautiful, and they're sitting somewhere in storage until they know where they should be put.
And as you said, officials in San Juan County, though, say that the planning meetings and processes related to this have been put on hold. And they're saying because of this review process.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the BLM has acquiesced to those demands, and you know things kind of blew up back in June when the what's called the Bears Ears Commission. It's a group of tribal representatives who've been given a kind of a special advisory role in management planning. Well, they go on a hike that turned out to be kind of informal with BLM and Forest Service staff to some archaeological sites that needed to be, needed more protection. They were getting a lot of visitation. And the San Juan County Commission got wind of this and kind of made a big stink over it and got the BLM to acknowledge that, no, there's no monument planning is happening. It's all on hold.
You know, but having the monument declared draws attention to the area. You expect, I guess, increased visitation, but if you haven't done anything to maybe protect from a conservation perspective, if you have these sites, do we know if there's an uptick in things like looting or...
Yeah, well, it's hard to know. There's a few years ago, there was a documented uptick in looting when the Bears Ears Monument discussion became a big story here. So in a sense, Bears Ears is already, the word is already out on the Bears Ears.
Yeah, anecdotally, I think we're hearing down there that there's a lot more visitation to the area.
Yeah. Visitation's definitely going up, and
that in itself causes problems because, you know, it's not always just looting. Sometimes it's accidental destruction of some of these antiquities down there, just because of the additional traffic that comes through. But yeah, looting is also a concern as well. And so, Brian, it kind of hits the nail on the head is that, you know, we've got this uncertainty there now. The state proclaims that they're worried about the antiquities and protecting the antiquities, but they're not allowing any process to go forward, any money to be expended, any resource to be deployed to actually protect these resources. And in fact, they're trying to eliminate, as Brian mentioned, 93% of the monument that is designed to try to provide some level of protection for these resources. And so it's really, right now, I think, even if we take everybody at their word, which I'm not sure that we can do, it's created this limbo for the entire area where you're attracting visitors, but you're not actually providing any protection for anything on the ground.
And kind of, I mean, I guess the review process is, from the state's perspective, kind of a dream come true. I mean, you've got a Republican administration, responding, I guess, to the desires of a Republican state government.
Yeah, and if anybody's really anxious to read my column for the weekend and doesn't want any spoilers, they should turn the radio down right now because this is what I write about. But I'll tell you when to turn it back up. The frustrating part about this for me is they claim that the governor claims that he's worried about protecting these antiquities, but he wants to get rid of most of the monument. But he doesn't, and there's a concern, as Brian mentioned, that it'll be a magnet for tourists and looters and recreationists. But then they want to not only keep part of the monument, you know, a concentrated portion of the monument, but they also want to create these recreation areas. Recreation areas, as you might imagine, are areas where people are encouraged to recreate, and that includes ATVs, that includes ORVs, that includes mountain biking, that includes all of these uses that usually don't exist inside a monument or inside wilderness areas in a monument. And so, really, what they're doing is creating this. They're sort of accentuating, or you know, making the magnet 10 times stronger to draw people there, but also eliminating a lot of the protections that could be in place to protect these resources. And as Brian mentioned, there's a lot of antiquities down there. There's nearly 8,500 sites that have been identified. And when we say sites, we're not talking about, oh, there's an arrowhead or, oh, there's a piece of pottery. These are substantial. 5,500 of them have been determined to be eligible for National Registry of Historic Places, and so these are significant sites that we're talking about, and we're not, and right now they're completely unprotected.
Brian Maffley, are the sites that Robert's describing, are they Anasazi? What is the culture?
Yeah. The Cedar Mesa was inhabited for thousands of years. So you have a very long unbroken archaeological record there. The resources that are kind of the marquee things were left by the Anasazi, the ancestral Puebloans, who apparently left the area very suddenly about 1250 AD, right, in that neighborhood.
Right.
And so what they've left behind are cliff dwellings, granaries, middens, you know, grave sites, the evidence of their daily lives. It's all over the place.
And it's the reason you saw all these tribes come together to protect this area is because it is ground that all of their ancestors lived on or traveled through. You know, we're talking about the Utes, the Navajo, the Hopi, all of these tribes were part of it.
And this is the Intertribal Coalition, the group that advocated for the designation of the Bear's Ears, waiting to see something happen. They've also threatened to fight any changes to this in the courts, correct?
Yeah, the Navajo Nation Attorney General Ethel Branch has made it very clear in our discussions with her that any attempts to either reduce the level of protection or shrink the boundaries will be met with a lawsuit.
And that sort of, you know, we've kind of been wasting time with this Zinke Nothing Burger memo that got leaked out, because there nothing's come of it. There's still, I was told even before this came out that, you know, watch for this, because he's not done his homework, because they don't have the staff in Interior to actually do the on the ground work that needs to be done.
Yeah.
And so we've wasted now 9 months back and forth, and you know, we know it's going to end up in a lawsuit. At some point, I just wish they would, you know, try to rescind it, and then we can go to court and get some finality on this.
Well,
and then actually, you know, start the work that needs to be done to protect the area.
At issue, of course, in the court case would be whether or not a president can alter or eliminate monuments like this under the Antiquities Act. That's going to be the central point of this case.
Absolutely, and there seems to be a lot of difference of opinion about whether a president has authority under the Antiquities Act to change a proclamation that his predecessor did.
The secretary in his report said there's no question that the president has the authority, and points to the incidences where it's been done before, but none of those have ever been challenged in court, and they've all been done more as minor adjustments to with some sort of compelling national interest, usually in a time of war where we need wood or we need some sort of resource like that.
Yeah.
We actually have to go to a break here in a second, but Brian, how would this play out? That President Trump would sign a national monument order or a new order that changes or tries to change those boundaries?
I imagine that's how it would be. There would be an executive order to change the boundaries and, according to Zinke's recommendations, make some other changes to protect things like hunting and fishing rights, whatever that is.
And also there would need to be some congressional action as well for the national recreation areas. And also on Grand Staircase, I mean, the governor said last week he can see it being divided into three or four smaller monuments, you know, chopped into pieces. And you know, the governor isn't just saying that out of thin air. I mean, there's been some discussion of this, I think, in private meetings.
And that's about all we know about what might happen to Grand Staircase. Is that correct, Brian? Well,
that's right.
They have their eye on the coal there, right? There's a lot of coal. The nice thing about Bear's Ears is there's almost no energy resources in the place. And the maps that we got from the state kind of depicted that there's just nothing there. Now, Grand Staircase is different. There's a lot of coal, and so there's going to be a lot of people trying to get their hands on that coal, I think.
How tense, you know, down in San Juan County where the Bear's Ears National Monument is and is waiting. How tense are things on the ground between the two groups of stakeholders? You know, you've got the Intertribal Coalition and or proponents and opponents, for want of a better word, of this monument.
Yeah, they have a lot of differences, and they're not just differences of opinion; they're differences of fact. Phil Lyman and the other members of the San Juan County Commission, you know, are denying that these archaeological resources are even under any kind of threat. And that the folks in San Juan County have shown that they can be trusted to steward these places, while the tribes and environmental groups have believed that these places are getting looted. There's a 100-year record of looting on Cedar Mesa, and And these places do need to be protected. There needs to be more rules in place, but also the access to these areas also needs to be protected for Native Americans.
Okay, and so I mean, right now we're just kind of in a holding pattern until the president acts, or what if the president doesn't act?
Well, I think the thinking is that there will be some action at some point that will include some involvement of Congress. And but, you know, the people I've talked to both at the state and national level don't anticipate it's going to be any time. There's not a great urgency, they don't feel like, to do this. And so it could be weeks or months before we actually see action on it.
And just to close this out, could that delay lead to a lawsuit of its own for not implementing the national mind?
That seems like a possibility. I've run that very question by some lawyers who work for the tribes and environmental groups, and they weren't sure. It was like, well, what would you sue over? It's not really clear yet.
We will look, Brian, to you for some more reporting on this, and thank you for the window into all of it that you have provided. Yeah. Listeners, you're tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We're going to take a longer than normal break because it is pledge drive, but stay with us.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members, and support for science reporting on Utah Public Radio comes from the Utah State University Ecology Center, providing training opportunities for today's science communicators, one story at a time.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines on Utah Public Radio. Tom Williams with Danny Hayes. We're enjoying the program. This is a program that many listeners, Danny, have said they really enjoy. It's become a hit. So thanks to KCPW for developing this program, and we have a nice partnership with them. It's a simple idea, powerful idea. Every week, Roger McDonough, the host, gathers reporters from Salt Lake Tribune, and they go behind the headlines.
They definitely do. I love the concept.
Get your microphone up here.
There we go.
I think we've got it. There we go.
There we go. I love the concept that there's a partnership between the Salt Lake Tribune, a great newspaper, with a great radio station, KCPW, and then now Utah Public Radio. You can hear this show statewide. And it's a great way to get caught up on the news. You could not listen to the news all week, but then get caught up on Friday.
That's right. And somebody yesterday with their pledge was saying that they love Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and that's how they get caught up on the news. And they were saying it's a little dangerous because it's a comedy show. You don't know whether it's real or
satire.
Not.
Satire.
And of course, many people are getting their news exclusively from the comedy shows,
The late shows. But public radio.
Here's a little safer space. These are actual reporters from the Salt Lake Tribune. And it's a great thing to have a roundup of the news.
I know. I feel safe listening to it. These reporters, they've been studying it all week. They've been keeping up on it. And then Roger McDonough, he comes in and lays it all out, and we know about everything in an hour.
And here's the way to support that. I hear from a lot of people who say they appreciate it, want to support it. Here's how you do that. We hope to hear from you. 800-826-1495. 800-826-1495 is the toll-free number. And the best way, if you're listening in the evening, we do repeat this in the evening, best way to get us in the evening to pledge is upr.org. That's upr.org.
Yeah, head over to upr.org. On there, you can also see some of the pictures of the premiums that we're giving out, the thank you gifts. We've got a number of things there, including a subscription to the New York Times, so even another news source for you.
So just 30 seconds left here in this break. Just again, a reminder that this is a collaboration between UPR and KCPW, and we do need your support for this great programming. And the way to do that is to go to upr.org, or you can call us 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Taylor Anderson, public lands reporter Brian Maffley, education reporter Benjamin Wood, and Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke. Call us up with your questions and comments. The number is 801-355-8255. To a couple of legislative items now. And actually, we don't have reporter Lee Davidson here with us, but he wrote about lawmakers making quick work of a couple of bills during the special legislative session, bills related to Operation Rio Grande around Salt Lake City's homeless shelter. One bill which passed means that the city can close Rio Grande Street and lease it to the state of Utah. I think that part of that has already happened. The other piece of this is funding, nearly $5 million to keep paying for Operation Rio Grande. And Robert Gerke, Salt Lake Tribune columnist, let's actually just go straight to you here. Quick action on all of this. And the city, the county, and the state continue to collaborate on this effort. Is this a sign of, you know, good coordination?
Well, yeah, it seems to be right now. I mean, and it needs to be done because it's not a problem that any one of these entities can handle on their own. So the fact that the state is, you know, involved in terms of, you know, creating this pen, I guess, for lack of a better term, yeah, this safe space that people can go to, and putting up some money now is important. And I think what's going to be more important is as we look down the road and we see us entering the phase two and phase three of this program, that's where the money is going to be more important, when you actually have people who need treatment for mental health and addiction issues, and then you need to create a affordable housing for them to transition into. Right now, that's not really there. The money is, they're talking about $67 million in long term on this.
Which they will address in the general session.
In the general session, yeah. And so they're going to have to come up with more money at that point, because that's not something that the city and the county can do on their own either. So, you know, this is a good first step, I think, and it's good that the state is now taking the lead and sort of bringing people together. There was a lot of squabbling for the first several months or even year of this project. But I think we're starting to see some progress now. Now, if you live outside of Pioneer Park and one of the neighborhoods surrounding downtown Salt Lake, you might disagree, as you've seen people kind of being dispersed and moving into your neighborhoods. But I think in the long term, this actually has us on a good trajectory.
There's much to be seen when it comes to what's getting accomplished. The Road Home Shelter is slated to be closed in 2019. New shelters and other locations will be coming online, and time will tell what this means for people whose lives have been upended by homelessness. We're going to leave this topic behind for a moment, though, and move on to a couple of other stories related to the state legislature. And let's turn to Taylor Anderson, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter. In past shows, we've talked about the potential for Utah to eliminate the sales tax on food. But this week, there was some actual momentum behind that potential, a Republican state lawmaker providing the push. Tell us the story, Taylor.
Yeah, so if you remember from last session, Republicans in the Senate tried to, they were looking at raising the tax. Utah lowered the sales tax on food from the normal 4.7% that people pay on everything else that's not food to it's 1.75 on the state level and 1.2 up to 1.25 at the local level for a total of 3%. Mm-hmm. They wanted to raise that to 4.7 because it's a really stable tax. Even in recessions, actually people spend more on food. So no matter what happens in the economy, that revenue stream is always coming in pretty stable. So there was a deal to try to raise that back up to 4.7% last year. It fell apart at the end of the session, and they promised to study it in the off season. Now it looks like they've actually reversed course, and lawmakers are considering eliminating the state's portion entirely.
So having studied it, they've decided that the sales tax on food is actually, despite the fact that it, you know, creates that revenue stream, is undesirable. Did they give? Do we have reasons for that?
Well, there's a coalition that's trying to. It's I guess gaining momentum with legislators that says, you know, everybody we could make food more affordable. Everybody needs food to survive. Why do we have a tax on it? It's regressive, they say, and I guess they've convinced some legislators that they might actually have a case. Mm-hmm. Representative Tim Quinn from Heber City he's opened a bill file. Right,
yeah.
He's opened a bill file that would do that. It would eliminate it from everything. You know, there was another proposal that we could maybe keep it on soda, candy, things that, you know, people probably don't need to do, but I don't think there's much appetite in the legislature to do that. So it's more likely that they would just get rid of it, the state's portion, keep the local portion. So the new tax would be 1.25, the local, possibly.
Okay. And at the same time, taxes would be raised on other, you know, would be raised elsewhere.
Right. If they wanted to make it revenue neutral and not lose a bunch of money, they would have to raise the general sales tax by 0.24%. So the new, it would be just below 5%. It would be 4.94% on everything else.
I'm going to just remind listeners to join us with your thoughts, questions, comments. Call us at 801-355-8255 or comment at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. You know, you mentioned that exception that that they were kind of throwing around there, having you know, not keeping the food tax on specific items. You said soda. What were the other items again?
It was soda, candy, bottled water, and dietary supplements.
Why those those exceptions? Because they're just they're something
unhealthy. Yeah.
Okay.
But when I asked Representative Quinn about that, he said, "This is not a Bloomberg tax. I'm not going to raise the tax on candy as like a punishment for consuming unhealthy things." And I talked to some others, and they said, you know, if we're going to do this, their preference would be getting rid of it on all goods, consumable goods.
Robert Gerke, Salt Lake Tribune columnist, eliminating the food tax. Does this proposal surprise you? I mean, kind of eliminating the food tax, I guess. And do you think it would pass?
Well, I'm not terribly surprised that somebody's proposing it. I think it's right now I would think it's probably unlikely that it's going to get a lot of traction in the legislature. But I think, you know, as Taylor mentioned, they're kind of doing this holistic look at the tax code right now. Trying to refine both the income side of it and the sales tax side of it. And so, you know, this needs to be part of the discussion, whether it's actually going to go anywhere. I kind of doubt it, because the argument that they have is that by removing the sales tax on food, you've created more instability in the remaining, you know, on the other side of the equation. So your tax revenue is going to fluctuate more, and that creates problems when we go into a downturn. So I think the likelihood that was the whole argument for bringing it back in the first place, because it is stable. So I think the likelihood of it actually coming, you know, being rescinded is pretty slim right now.
Proponents of the measure, of course, say that it will help, as Taylor pointed out, help people who are lower income, who are affected by that. I think even more so in recessions, they would be affected by the food tax.
Right. The thinking is that everybody needs to buy food, right? You know, and so you know, if they could tax air, that would probably be a pretty stable revenue stream as well, although sometimes our air gets pretty bad in the winters. I mean, that's the thinking, is that everybody's always going to need to buy food, whether you're rich or poor. And so it's a very reliable source of revenue to run government operations on.
We'll wait to see if there's a Boston air party. Taylor, this is going to come up in the general session, this bill file, you know, the proposal to eliminate the tax.
It could. Just opening a bill file doesn't mean that it's going to come forward. So it's like Robert said, part of the overall conversation about tax reform, and it's too early to tell whether it's going to actually gain steam and go forward.
Okay. Before we head to another break and turn to Benjamin Wood and some education stories, Taylor, you wrote about some efforts underway in another legislative committee having to do with fixing state code around a very specific issue, and it's about elected officials who become mentally unfit for office, and there's a background to the story. But what is the problem that West Valley Senator Daniel Thatcher is trying to address with this?
Yeah, and he tried not to bring up the actual story, but it stems from former Salt Lake County Recorder Gary Ott, who apparently has, it's a permanent mental incapacity. We don't know exactly what it is, but he was showing signs of possible dementia while he was in office for years. Kept getting picked up by the police after bystanders would call them concerned about an adult who was confused, he was lost. And that happened for years, and he was still the county recorder. Once that became an issue, the county tried, county leaders, the county council, the mayor, the DA, Sim Gill, they tried to find a way. They scoured the Constitution, the statutes, to remove him or force him from office in some way, and found they had no way to do that. So Senator Daniel Thatcher has made it his, it was actually proposed, they've been working on it for a couple years. Representative Chavez-Hauck had one last year, but it There were some concerns that we were kind of stepping toward recall elections, which Utah doesn't have. And so they wanted to narrow this as much as they could to actually get it to a point where it could pass the legislature without those kinds of concerns. And Thatcher thinks he's done that now.
And that proposal is essentially, finding a way to remove somebody from office. What are the nuts and bolts of it?
Right. So he's limited it to six counties that have... any county with five or more legislative officers that run the county, that means six counties in Utah, no cities, and if an elected official, we're not talking about the governor, attorney general, legislators, it's only county elected officials who might have some sort of mental incapacity, because that's actually in the Constitution. To hold office, you have to be cognizant, I guess, and aware. And so if in those six counties, the legislative body was concerned, unanimous vote could request a mental evaluation of whatever individual we're talking about.
Hmm. An issue also that Taylorsville Democratic Representative Karen Kwan brought up was whether if someone is removed from office for mental incapacity, they can later return to public office if there's a change in their sort of mental health status.
Right, and she wasn't the only one. Craig Hall also had that question. He ended up voting in favor of moving forward with this right now, but... yeah, there were some concerns that Senator Thatcher says are in the bill. He's pretty sure that he's addressed all these questions, and it's just a matter of fleshing it out in committee, I guess.
Robert Gerke, I'll let you have the last word on this topic. A needed fix?
I think the Garriott saga that Taylor mentioned pointed to the fact that we have a vacuum here that needs to be addressed. I mean, there's language, as he mentioned, in the U.S. Constitution, and to remove somebody from office if they're not able to, you know, fulfill the duties of their office, and when you have your hands tied and you can't do anything, then, you know, that the people aren't being well served in that situation. And so I think it's something that needs to be done. There is a risk that it could be used to be, you know, could be politicized. I'm not exactly clear on why they don't include the governor and the governor and attorney generals in the constitutional offices, but there needs to be some mechanism there, I think, for removal for them as well.
Well, we'll see what happens as it makes its way through committees and through the legislature. Before we head to a break, I want to turn actually back to a story that we began at the beginning of the show, having to do with National Monuments recommendations and the Bears' Ears, because we have a caller on the line who has a comment about that. This is Carl from St. George. And Carl, what's your comment?
Good morning, gentlemen. Sorry I wasn't fast enough to get in, but... it seems to me that this issue that has arisen about Bears' Ears and the downsizing of the monument plays right into the hands of those who have opposed the monument from the beginning in this sense. Has anyone talked about, or at least I haven't heard, has anyone talked about the time that this would take to wind through the courts with all the appeals and all of the others in places throughout the United States that want a smaller footprint of their national monuments or parks in their state, whatever. I mean, this thing would take years and years and years and years to wind through the courts, wouldn't it?
You know, that's a question that I'm going to throw here to Brian Maffley, Salt Lake Tribune Public Lands reporter. Years of waiting through the courts?
I would imagine the caller is correct in for the Bears' Ears. There are entirely new issues of law that would need to be decided if a president undoes parts of a monument. And then, you know, it would be a district court ruling. It would go to the Tenth Circuit and then ultimately the Supreme Court. And yes, that could take years. Hmm. But for those states that want to reduce the monuments they already have, those lawsuits have been filed and resolved, and they've all been resolved in favor of keeping monuments the way they are. I mean, the Grand Staircase was
challenged.
Challenged, and a district court upheld that. That was the 1996 designation by Bill Clinton, and it's been resolved ever since. So now, the Grand Staircase, you know, 20 years after it's been affirmed, now there's a lot of uncertainty about that.
I think his point on the existing monuments that have management plans and are actively being managed, there's not going to be a change there if they're litigated while they're trying to shrink the boundaries. But yeah, Bears Ears is very vulnerable right now because there's not a management plan in place, and so it does delay that while it winds its way through courts. But it's almost an inevitability. I mean, it was gonna once Donald Trump won the presidency, you kind of saw that the management plan was going to be put on hold, that they weren't going to actually do any active planning. And even if they did start it, usually takes 3 to 4 years anyway. And so, yeah, we're looking a long ways down the road before we actually have any resources on the ground to provide the protection for this area.
Okay, well, Carl in St. George, thanks very much for your call. And
good question, Carl.
And it sounds like there's a bit more waiting to do. We're going to move on to some other topics after we take another slightly longer than normal break, because this station is in its fall pledge drive. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news wrap-up from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the 9th Annual Zion Canyon Music Festival, September 29th and 30th, under the cliffs of Zion National Park. Live continuous music, food booths, and a kid zone. More at ZionCanyonMusicFestival.com.
Thanks for joining us for Behind the Headlines here on Utah Public Radio. A great collaboration between KCPW in Salt Lake and Utah Public Radio. And we are looking for your support for Behind the Headlines. So this is a program that we selected in partnership with KCPW and took it statewide. Program that I suspect you enjoy because you're listening right now. It's one of my favorite programs. I get caught up on the news. It's great to get the recap and the roundup from the actual reporters. And, of course, today we're talking about Bears Ears and the other national monuments and other developments in the news, putting some context to it as well. Danny Hayes, I always appreciate the reporters' expertise, and they're able to give us a little more than they were able to in their actual stories. And so that's great to have a conversation with the reporters.
Yeah, that is true. And now that I'm thinking about it as a reporter, that's probably such a good outlet for them also, because I know for a reporter, you're always limited. You're cutting stuff down. And so there's probably some stuff that they're just aching about, things that they've learned that they couldn't put in their report, and they get to say it right here on Utah Public Radio.
Yeah. So if this is something that you appreciate, now's the time to support it. And here's how. You can go to 800-826-1495. A quick phone call, 800-826-1495. Become a new member of Utah Public Radio or renew your membership. Or if you're, especially if you're listening in the evening, upr.org is the place to go, upr.org.
Yeah, 800-826-1495. We have a number of volunteers in Pledge Central that are anxious to take your calls. 800-826-1495. If you're listening right now, perhaps you rely on this show to get you caught up on the news. So consider calling in, 800-826-1495, or go to upr.org.
A lot of thank you gifts available. We have the art calendar. We have a new mug. We have the subscription to the New York Times. That's for a pledge of $20 a month.
I understand that was what your favorite was.
That's my favorite. So maybe yours as well. So you go to upr.org and look at all those. And you can call us at 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. Or you can go to upr.org. Thank you so much for listening to Behind the Headlines. Now's the time when we're asking for you to support it with just a bit of money. 800-826-1495. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Benjamin Wood, Taylor Anderson, Brian Maffley, and Robert Gerke. Listeners, call us up with your comments and questions. That number is 801-355-TALK. To the ever-patient Benjamin Wood now. And Ben, I want to start with a story that appears in this morning's paper. It's about Western Governors University, which is based here in Utah. There was a federal audit, and it has some pretty sizable financial implications for the school. What was this audit, and what did it find?
Yeah, so for the last few years, this branch of the Department of Education has been looking at Western Governors, which is an online university. And what they determined was that WGU's classes don't qualify for federal financial aid because they're actually correspondence courses. And so WGU should, they recommend that they repay all that federal financial aid that they've gotten over the last 3 years.
How much money?
$712 million.
Just so I understand this, if it ended up being required, if Western Governors University does have to repay that money, would they have to recoup that money from the students to whom they had given this financial aid?
It's a good question. There's relatively little precedent here, but yeah, essentially WGU would have to find a way to cut that check, and however they do that is their business. They're a private nonprofit. They kind of do things their own way.
What's the school's response to this audit?
Outright dismissal. They are quite calm and unconcerned.
Utah Senator Mike Lee also responded to this in sort of saying Western Governors University is being unfairly smeared here, or maybe I'm putting words in his mouth. What did he say?
Yeah, what Senator Lee and what the school is saying is that the auditors were relying on a old-fashioned and narrow application reading of the federal law, because obviously technology has changed a lot since the Higher Education Act was passed decades ago. There has been some updates, but it talks about the way technology facilitates interaction with professors, and WGU doesn't really have professors in the traditional sense. They have teaching and, coaches and mentors and et cetera. So they're saying that, the spirit of the law is being followed, if not the traditional letter of the law.
There's this quote from the audit that's kind of striking that you reported on. It says, none of these 69 courses, and that's 69 out of 102 courses on offer, none of these courses, quote, could be reasonably considered as providing regular and substantive interaction between students and instructors. And this is because of the online nature of the school?
It is. When you attend an online school like WGU, it's not like a traditional university class where you log on at a set time every day and hear a lecture by a professor. Instead, you have tasks to complete, you have materials to read, you have assignments to turn in, and you don't have that back and forth between student and faculty that you would expect from a traditional classroom setting. The law says you have to have that substantive contact. The auditors are saying these courses do not. WGU is claiming that it's a misreading of what the law
it's
wants.
It's about what substantive contact is, Robert Kirky.
Ben, does this have any ramifications for their accreditation or the diplomas that people have received over the last 3 years?
At the moment, this has no ramifications at all. These are only recommendations. It's unclear if the DOE were to accept this audit report and demand these recommendations. It's unclear whether their accreditation or their diplomas would be at risk. They're currently accredited. They were recently renewed for accreditation. Mm-hmm. That remains intact. And like Senator Lee said, this is unlikely to be pressed against the school.
School was founded by a group of Western governors, including Utah Governor Mike Leavitt. Mm-hmm. How many years ago?
About 20 years ago. They just hit their anniversary.
Ben, what happens next? The Department of Education, they've got this audit. Do they make some sort of decision on whether or not Western Governors has to repay this money, or is it already decided?
Yeah, it's not decided yet. Essentially, what would happen would be the Department of Education would review this report, and they would decide whether or not to adopt these recommendations. If they did so, then the Western Governors University would have some tough decisions to make. But most signs indicate that these recommendations will stay as just recommendations.
Well, what about going forward with financial aid coming to the school in future years?
Yeah, for now, that pipeline has not been severed. The school is just keeping on.
Okay. Guys, we are severely limited on time here, and so I want to turn to something else, and it's something that, Ben, you covered also this past week on the education beat. A lot of feedback over a policy that makes health classes, PE classes, and art classes optional for middle school students. Feedback that was received by the Utah Board of Education. Tell us about this policy, and then if you can sort of help us sort out the uproar that's around it.
Yeah, so, until now, if you're a 7th and 8th grader, there's state rules that say you take math, you take English, you take science, you take health, gym. Your schedule is kind of laid out at a state level. The State Board of Education has said, instead of doing that, why don't we give to districts the power to say, here's what you have to do in 7th and 8th grade. So on the one hand, you have people praising this decision as a return to local control. On the other hand, you have arts, health, and physical education advocates who are concerned that the optionality will make these classes cease to be participated in.
Where did that policy come from? This was recommended by somebody and then adopted by the board?
Yeah, and the way the school board does their policies, it's not always clear who the sponsoring entity was. But, you know, there is a cohort of the state school board that is strong local control advocates. I would expect this came originated from them. But it's just this idea of giving more power to districts to determine the educational experience in their schools.
At this Board of Education meeting, was it mostly people in favor, mostly people opposed who showed up? What reasons did each side give?
Yeah, I mean, the meeting was pretty well split between the two. As far as reasons, just a lot of concern that the generalization of education, the idea that, you know, you may not want to take an art class, but then you do and you love it. You know, they're worried that that might go away. They're also worried about just how this is going to be adopted around the state, if there'll be differences from one area to the other.
Well, we're not going you know, greatly in depth here because we're almost out of time. But Robert Gerke, I've given you the last word on a number of stories today, and here you go again.
The
optional
last word with Robert Gerke.
Yeah, we should patent that. Optional middle school courses that didn't used to be optional. As an opinion columnist, you must have an opinion.
Well, I must. You know, I think the one that kind of is troubling to me the most, I think, is the health requirement, because you know, these kids need to know basic fundamental things about how the human body works, and it's those are the types of things that I think local districts might be inclined to abandon or get rid of, specifically sex education. And given our rates of STDs in the state, it's something that we need more of and not less of. The PE, you know, kids are getting chubby these days, just generally speaking. PE wouldn't hurt, but I guess if the locals want to get rid of PE, then that's probably their prerogative. They would be, I guess, under this proposal. There are options for kids to do other things in other ways, and the arts, you know, we've kind of driven the arts out of our school to a large extent anyway, and I think that the fact that, you know, these kids are spending basically half of a year, usually it's at one semester, doing learning about art, I think it's a good thing. But I guess it goes back to whether we think the locals are willing to do that. But the health one is the one that really kind of gives me some concern.
Well, local control is kind of in line with what some of the advocates that Ben mentioned who showed up at this meeting were saying. Ben, I'm actually going to give you the last word. This policy is now sort of just on hold, or
no? This policy is passed. I mean, it is. Huh? It's the way things are unless the board proactively intervenes and reverses themselves. It has been voted upon and stamped with approval.
And are they considering doing anything with it? Do we know?
We do not know. They have a meeting coming up in a couple of weeks. That would be the time. Yeah, we'll see. The original rule, the vote was 9-6. You have to have at least 8 votes. So if 2 of them switched, you know, their thinking on the issue, that would be enough. It's kind of a wait and see.
So now we watch the local school boards to see how they implement it, right?
Right, and that's what the school board is saying. They're saying, you know, if your local school district gets rid of art, go talk to them. You know, this it shouldn't be us managing these complaints. It should be at that local level.
Then why do we have a state school board at all?
And that's an ideological question that I'm not in a position to answer.
Not prepared to answer. All right. Well, maybe it will be answered at some point. Guys, we are at the end of the show, and we need to turn to our underplayed stories of the week, the final segment. And Ben Wood, I'll leave it with you. The ball is in your court.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not underplayed, but just while we've been talking, there's some breaking news out of Washington for Education. The Dear Colleague letter that outlines requirements for campuses to investigate rape and sexual assault has been rescinded. In its place, there's some recommendations from Secretary DeVos, including the option for our schools to use a clear and convincing evidence standard, which is a little bit higher of a bar to clear than what we currently have with the preponderance of evidence standard. So a lot of questions out there. We'll be chasing this throughout the day, so look at sltrib.com for updates.
Check it out. Okay. Yeah. Taylor Anderson, I'll go to you for your – actually, let's go to Brian Maffley for your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week, since you got a microphone in front of your face.
Well, very much under the radar, the Bureau of Land Management finally terminated a very controversial lawman, Special Agent Dan Love, who's – was the most reviled lawman in Utah before that Salt Lake City detective arrested a nurse at the University Hospital. But Dan Love was a very skilled officer in conducting undercover investigations, but he alienated local law enforcement all over Utah, and for years the leadership of our state has been pushing for the man's firing. That happened as a result not of, you know, Utah politicians applying pressure, but some Office of the Inspector General within the Department of Interior found that, Agent Love was mishandling evidence and kind of abusing the perks of his office. So,
okay.
Anyway.
All right. Well, that's at sltrip.com as well. We can find it there. Or it's just, that's just a story
it's so underplayed. It might be hard to find that.
We'll check it out. We'll look for it anyways. Taylor Anderson, your pick for underplayed story.
It's more fallout, I guess, from my colleague Robert Gerke's column on the sham battle from Wellsville. Courtney Tanner wrote a couple stories because the city's having a period of self-reflection on this this fake battle that they're doing. So she went up there and went to a town hall. So she's got a story out from yesterday that had some interesting comments on both sides of how they're going to depict Native Americans going forward.
Really interesting reading. And that's Taylor Anderson's pick, the Wellsville sham battle. Robert Gerke, who covered that story, what's your pick for underplayed story?
Well, this one has actually got a fair amount of attention, but it's, I think, the most fascinating ongoing story right now. And this is the disappearance of the owner of Big Ed's.
Oh, right.
This, if you've gone to the University of Utah, you've been to Big Ed's and you've probably been there hungover like I was, and you probably had breakfast there. But the owner, one day they didn't open and the owner's disappeared and they don't know where he went. The son is looking for him. There's all sorts of theories about what happened and why he fled. But it's sort of the end of an institution for university students and also just a really interesting mystery right now.
We've been contemplating doing a serial style podcast on what
happened.
Yeah,
there you go.
And where are we going to get our god awfuls? Another breakfast dish. Where are the roundhouses?
I wasn't sure if I could say god awful on the radio.
You can. It's a dish. Right. Okay. Well, I'm going to go for my pick for underplayed story with the acquisition by the Mormon Church of the printer's manuscript for the 1830 edition of the Book of Mormon, a $35 million purchase price for this manuscript, which, according to a rare book dealing friend of mine, Kent Schantz, is the most paid ever for a manuscript. The second is a $30.8 million purchase of a Leonardo Codex by Bill Gates back in 1994. So.
You know, they leave them in hotel rooms now. You can pick one up there if you want.
They got these guys walking around, too, that will just give you one.
Yeah. $35 million seems steep.
All right. Robert Gerke, Ben Wood, Brian Maffley, and Taylor Anderson, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for joining us here on Behind the Headlines.
Thanks. Have a good weekend.
That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW up in Logan at Utah Public Radio. We've got Tom Williams, Spencer Holsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen. Thanks as well to the show's producer, Emily Means. And both of these stations are in our fall pledge drive. Please do your part to support this program and all of the great local content you hear on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. That does it for this edition of the show. I'm Roger McDonough. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines. Have a great weekend.
I say try tofu.
And I say give me some chocolate instead. On a very special edition of Zorba Pastor on Your Health, we'll serve up a recipe for
chocolate banana cake.
Way better than tofu, I think, on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.
Join us this Sunday at noon on Utah Public Radio.
A service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University, this is Utah Public Radio. Heard statewide on KUSR, Logan, KUSK, Vernal, KUSL, Richfield, KUST, Moab, KCEU, Price, and KUSU-FM, Logan.